Kia ora and welcome to Airman's Podcast, episode 246. Today is Wednesday, February 2nd, 2011. Well, there's certainly been a lot of news in the news, hasn't there? But today's episode has virtually nothing to do with the news. So consider it a bit of a break or maybe a bit of a distraction, I don't know, whatever. But if I do want to start today with a couple of items from the news in this part of the world. First, there is a major cyclone that's about to slam into the coast of Queensland in Australia. It's a Category 5 cyclone called Yasa, Y-A-S-A, which they expect will have wind gusts of up to 300 kilometers per hour, which is about 186 miles per hour. And it will strike the coast of Queensland at about 10 p.m. local time tonight, which is 7 a.m. Wednesday Eastern Standard Time, 4 a.m. on the West Coast, and 2 a.m. in Honolulu. But it's also, of course, 1 a.m. Thursday, tomorrow, here in New Zealand, because we're so many hours ahead of Queensland this time of year. It will be a very big deal indeed. There has been a mandatory evacuation ordered for parts of Queensland, with the Australian Armed Forces helping with that. And they've also actually been strategically placing folks to help with immediate aftermath, especially restoring the cell phone coverage so that there's at least minimal communication capability after the storm passes. They did warn people that they should be prepared to be self-sufficient for an extended period of time. But they couldn't tell them what that meant because they didn't know how bad the storm was going to be at that stage. They didn't know when it was going to hit precisely, and they didn't know where it was going to hit. So they couldn't really be sure. But there are parts, especially in the more rural and remote areas, that could very well be cut off for many, many, many days, maybe a week or so even. Who knows, especially if the flooding is bad. And, of course, this all comes hot on the heels of the flooding that struck Queensland not so very long ago, the massive flooding that they had that even affected Brisbane. And so the last thing that that state needs is another disaster. I mean, not that you ever need any disasters, but certainly not two so close to each other. They're saying that this will be the worst storm to ever hit Queensland. I don't know how it compares to ones that have hit other parts of Australia, but they are saying it is on track to be the worst to ever strike Queensland. So it's a very big deal indeed. Now, I should say that this won't affect New Zealand at all, because some of you will be wondering. It's going in the opposite direction from us, and Queensland is a very long way from New Zealand. So it won't affect us at all, and which is, I mean, that's good. But we still, here on this side of the Tasman, are very concerned about and thinking about our cousins across the Tasman and hope that all is well and that there ends up being no loss of life and damage is minimal. But it does look to be a very big deal indeed, and it will probably make the world news because of how severe it promises to be. So, that's the biggest news right now. But in New Zealand news, far less dramatic but important to us, the Prime Minister has announced the date for the next election is Saturday, November 26th, about 10 months away, which leads some people to suspect that maybe since he's running on a platform of privatizing state-owned assets, which means selling them off, that he's not really worried about the Labour Party opposition, that he thinks he can coast to victory. I don't know if that's true, and I don't know if so, if that is justified, but we'll know that soon enough. And, of course, I intend to be talking a lot about the election over the weeks and months ahead, but that is for future episodes. Today's episode was inspired by a phone comment that I received, and it seemed particularly timely. So let's listen to that message now.
Hi, Arthur. It's Bank here. A belated happy birthday, and I hope you had a great evening out, just the two of you. We're all settled back in the U.S. after our recent trip to New Zealand, and that was a lot of fun. In fact, it was so much fun that we're now planning a six-week trip in winter, the New Zealand winter, our summer, to Dunedin, my hometown, which is possibly a sign of complete madness. I don't know. Certainly no one goes to Dunedin for the weather. And this has been making me think a lot about attitudes towards a reasonable room temperature in both New Zealand and America, and how people heat their houses and what temperature they think they should be. So back when I was a kid, nobody had central heating, and you used space heaters or maybe a wood stove to heat the areas you were in most of the time. And the less used rooms just didn't get heated in winter, and it got really cold, and you learned to get dressed really, really fast in your bedroom. But I've noticed now that there's a lot of talk, particularly in sort of political discourse, about leaky houses, and that this is a problem and things need to be done about them. Is this reflecting a change in attitude towards how warm houses should be and how people should heat them? Is this what's going on? I ask you because you are my informant about all things New Zealand. And have you noticed a shift in attitude from the one of my childhood a good 30, 40 years ago? And then I was also wondering how you've gone on acclimatizing to the cooler room temperatures of New Zealand after growing up in America. I've certainly acclimatized the other way, and when I go home, I now find my mother's house so cold and spend all my time kvetching about it. Okay, well, just some random thoughts. I hope you're having a wonderful month, and I'll look forward to hearing a podcast soon. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Bank. Always good to hear from you. And thank you for the birthday wishes. We did have a very good night indeed. We went to a restaurant called Blitza Pizza, which is, I think they've got a few locations in Auckland, but this one is not far from us. Despite the name, it's not actually a pizza place, at least not exclusively. It's more of a Mediterranean restaurant than anything because they have a lot of Greek food as well. And they've just recently installed air conditioning, which is sort of relevant to today's topic in itself. But I have to admit, when you said that you were going to Dunedin for 6 weeks in winter, my first thought was that you're a bit mad because it is cold. But my second thought was 6 weeks. I wonder if there's going to be any time in Auckland in that. But this topic is particularly timely because, as Nigel said on the Third Colony this past weekend, he and I have been looking at houses recently with an eye toward possibly moving. Now, don't read too much into that, because that doesn't mean we're about to or we're going to. It just means we're exploring our options, as we do from time to time, to make sure we're in the best space for us. Now, we like where we're at. We like the house, but it doesn't really meet our needs. It has a few shortcomings, and so we're exploring our options. Should we find a place that does meet our needs? Should we add on to this place? What should we do? And so this is a work in progress, and I'll probably come back to that at some stage. But for now, we have been looking at houses. And so I'm probably a bit more up with what's currently on offer in houses than I normally would be. So this is quite timely indeed. But to answer one of your later questions first, have I acclimated? I absolutely have. And I'm used to the temperatures of New Zealand houses now. But like pretty much all the American expats I know, the first winter I was in New Zealand was the coldest I was in my entire life, without a shadow of a doubt. Even though I come from a place that's much colder than Auckland. I mean, Chicago gets bitter cold in the wintertime and snowy. And we don't get snow in Auckland, and it never gets that cold. But nevertheless, I was very cold. And one of the main reasons for that is because New Zealand houses are cold by World Health Organization standards. Too cold, actually. And below the healthful level. And the reason for that is twofold. First is what Bank touched on about the lack of adequate heating. A lot of houses in New Zealand historically have been heated by a wood fire of one sort or another. It might be in an enclosed freestanding thing. It might be an actual fireplace, whatever. It's got some sort of heating insert in the fire cavity. It's not just open fire usually. And combine that with space heaters. Now, the space heaters that are most typically used are oil column heaters, which are essentially radiators that are filled with oil instead of water, and they're heated by electricity and radiate the heat. They're reasonably good in a small room. The right size heater can do a pretty good job, but they're incredibly inefficient and use a lot of power to generate heat. So it's an expensive way of heating a house, and it's not typically used all the time. It's used, you know, to sort of warm up a room a bit before you go to bed, and then you turn it off. But another heater that has historically been used a lot are unflued gas heaters. And we're one of only two countries in the world that I know of, the other's Italy, that allows these things. What they are is they're heaters that use, we call them LPG tanks. Americans would call it propane. And it heats up, you light it and it heats up a certain, you know, reflecting heater thingy. And I don't know what it's called. And the size of the heater is depending on how many regions it lights up. So it's 1, 2, or 3 bar heater. And we had one for many years, and I hated it every winter because I would get chesty as soon as we started burning it. And they're also notorious for pumping out a lot of moisture, which ends up being condensation on the windows and on the furniture and the walls. It's just horrible. It encourages the growth of mold and mildew as well because of that. So it's a very unhealthy way, not even counting the indoor air pollution. It's a very unhealthy way to heat a house, but it's very efficient. It really does heat up and heat up fast. So that's why its popularity still lingers. But we gave up ours years ago because we started installing heat pumps wherever we lived. And that is the single most efficient way of heating with electricity. And they're becoming really quite popular in New Zealand in recent years. So this sort of gets to the changes in attitude that that Benk was asking about. People are beginning to expect their houses to be warmer and drier than they used to be. And so quite a few people are starting to install these heat pumps. But they, by and large, are for one room only, or you both install individual room ones. We actually did that in our previous house. We installed three separate room ones. And it's very unusual to have a central system as we do in this house. And the only reason we do is because there was already a ducted system in for a gas hot air furnace heater thingy. But it didn't work, as longtime listeners will remember. It was horrible. It didn't warm the house. It was installed upside down, in my opinion. And the vents should have been in the floor, not the ceiling. But be that as it may, the ducting was already there, so all we had to do was just get the system installed, and it ended up being less expensive than we'd had to have the whole thing done. And it works really well. But most people don't do that. Most people have, if they install air conditioning and heating, it's generally called air conditioning when they mean both heating and cooling. If they install it, it's for one room at a time, perhaps. And you see more and more of that. When you just drive around the streets, you'll see the condenser unit sitting outside the house, or the conduit going up the side of the house to the unit that's hanging on the wall on the other side. But one thing that has become very popular in the past few years is a system called HRV. Now, there are a couple of different brands, but that's the main one. And I believe it stands for heating recovery ventilation or something like that. And the way it works is it has vents in the ceiling, and it draws the air from inside the house, brings it up into the roof space, which is warm, usually very warm, but it's warmer and drier than the house itself. And it exchanges it through this filtering thingy and pumps it back into the house. So the idea is that it keeps the air moving, first of all, which is good because it helps prevent the accumulation of moisture. But the other thing that it does is it warms the air using the heat that's already in your roof space. It uses very little power because it's just a fan to run it. And I've heard that it uses no more power than a light bulb. Now, whether that's true, I don't know. I've actually never experienced one of these systems. So I don't know if they're any good. I don't know if they provide an adequate warmth. But it seems to me it's better than nothing. So these are becoming really quite popular. And I've noticed that in the real estate ads that we've been looking at, or when we look at real estate ads, it'll often be prominently displayed as if this is a really good thing, a good selling point. Now, to me, it wouldn't be necessarily, because I'm more interested in having heating and air conditioning, heating and cooling. But for a lot of people who perhaps have no heating system, this would be a real advance. Our next-door neighbors, well, we're in a little muse thing. One of our neighbors, our nearest neighbors, had HRV installed not long after they bought the house, which was 2 or 3 years ago now, I guess. And I've noticed they still have all their windows open on hot days. So obviously it doesn't do anything for cooling. But I mean, that's only a few months out of the year. The majority of the year is either cool or in winter, it's really cold. And you would need heating more. Now, of course, our houses here are completely different from your typical house. Well, for two reasons. First of all, there's massive insulation in the walls. And the reason for that is because this house is not built of wood. It's built of a system called cornerstone, which uses slabs of concrete with polystyrene, which Americans call styrofoam, on the outside, and then a plaster coating on the outside of that. So it's much more insulated than a typical house, and it's also much more quieter because of that. Insulation is something that is becoming a very big deal in new houses. Some of the home manufacturers will tout the R rating of their insulation, which is unheard of not so very long ago, only even a few years ago probably. You wouldn't see that as one of the things they're promoting, but now it is, because everyone's aware of conserving energy. And people are also starting to insulate under the floors of their house. Now, backing up a bit, a lot of New Zealand houses are built not on a concrete slab or on a poured concrete or concrete block foundation, but they're on what we call piles, which are essentially like telephone poles that have been driven into the ground. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that a lot of New Zealand is really hilly, and so you can't really you could build concrete foundations, but they'd be massive walls in some cases. But the other thing is that in a geologically active country, as New Zealand is, it makes more sense to do this because as the earth moves, the house can move with it and can sway and so on, instead of just the foundation cracking and collapsing and taking the house with it. So in other words, there's far less damage overall when the house is built on these wood piles, which can move in an earthquake. So that's one of the reasons why it's developed that way. Similar techniques are actually used in other countries. Britain has done that as well, but they don't use wood usually. They use concrete or steel driven way into the ground. There's actually a heating system that takes advantage of that too, but that's a whole other topic. But what that does in some cases is that means the underside of the house is exposed. Now, the floor insulation standard, and I believe still, is just this stuff that's called builder's – it's like a builder's foil. I don't know what it's called actually, which is a heavy-duty thing, shiny on one side, and it's like builder's paper on the other. And it's sort of it's put in like a wave over the floor joists before the subfloor is put down, the idea being, I guess, that it reflects cold away or something. I don't know. And that has been, until I believe it still is, the standard for underfloor insulation. Well, people are starting to change that. They're either putting the traditional, you know, fiberglass insulation between the floor joists, or they're getting this stuff called Expol. Well, that's the name brand, but that's the leading brand, certainly, which actually is a contraction of extruded polystyrene. And, of course, that's styrofoam. And it comes in these panels. I think they're meter a bit longer in length, and you get it to the width you need for your floor joist, and you just put it up there, and it's got little pins you can secure it in place, and it supposedly dramatically increases the R value. That's become quite popular as well, and sometimes you'll see that in real estate ads, the fact that they've got this stuff. So insulation is something that people are paying a lot more attention to. They're adding insulation to their roof spaces. Sometimes they're even having it blown into the walls, which is still a bit unusual in this part of the world, but every once in a while you see it. And a few years ago, well, it was before the last election, the Labour government announced plans to subsidize the insulation of homes in New Zealand, particularly those of low income or moderate means. And to its credit, when the current national-led government came into power, it continued that and decided to basically make it happen. And they have insulated quite a few homes. I don't actually have the figures on how many. I don't know that they've released that. Mind you, I didn't look either, but... But the point is they had this program to try to help people insulate their houses. Now, the cutoff, I think, was the year 2000 or maybe, I think it was 2000 or something like that. So houses that were built a while ago, actually, I think it was even before that. But at any rate, those were the houses that qualified for the insulation subsidy, which I think was like $1,500 or something, which certainly won't pay for the cost, but it does help bring the cost down and make it more affordable. And which is what the goal was. And so, you know, people are taking responsibility for dealing to the energy inefficiency and coldness of their homes. And certainly builders have responded by adding a lot more insulation, more than is required by code very often. And they're starting to install double and even triple glazed windows, whereas before that, single glazed was the norm. I mean, our house has nothing but single glazed windows anywhere. And so things are starting to change, and people are beginning to expect their houses to be warmer and drier and to not have to put on like three sweaters in order to be able to stand being in the house. But I exaggerate. I'm exaggerating. But in parts of the country, it does get bloody cold, and I'm pretty sure that they've always had different standards than warmer parts of the country have had. But I don't know that for certain. And I mean, I certainly can't imagine a house being built in, say, I don't know, in Queenstown, which is a winter resort area, built that had ever been built without insulation, because, I mean, it gets really cold there. I mean, it's cold as Chicago. So I'm sure that there must have been different standards for other parts of the country. But having said all that, Bank's experiences of having to hurry up and get dressed in the morning and all that are not unusual. I mean, Nigel talked on this podcast a long time ago about when he was a boy and he and his siblings would get a hot water bottle and take it to bed with them to warm up the bed a little bit when they were trying to go to sleep. And how when he got his first job, one of the first things he bought was an electric blanket, which is the kind that goes, you know, under the sheets and all that, you lie on top of it. So while his siblings were shivering with their hot water bottles, he got into a nice, cozy, warm bed. And he did that through the power of work. But the point is that those experiences were common, and people did those sorts of things. They had cold bedrooms and cold parts of the house, and they're beginning, I think, to not want that so much anymore. And they want to have nice, warm houses, and cooling hasn't quite caught on quite as much yet. This restaurant that just installed the air conditioning that I mentioned earlier, it has been open for many, many years, probably 8, if not more, years, and they're just now installing air conditioning. And it's really, it's not uncommon for places to be un-air conditioned. Recently, we went to the Denny's here on the North Shore, don't judge, and they actually have air conditioning now, but they weren't running it. They had some ceiling fans running instead. But mind you, they've cut costs everywhere else too, so why should that be a surprise? But they didn't have air conditioning at all for years, and then they finally installed it, and now they're not using it. Bastards. But that I think is the next frontier, because our summers are getting hotter. And they said at the beginning of this winter that New Zealand was on track. Actually, last month I think New Zealand was on track to have the hottest summer in recorded history. So, you know, I think these sorts of things are going to become more prevalent. And the fact that people are choosing more energy efficient options like heat pumps and so on is a good thing, because in the wintertime we often have trouble with the hydro lakes in the South Island being too low, because typically they don't get rain in the wintertime, which is really strange because the rest of the country does. But anyway, so these attitudes are changing. Oh, that's Sunny. She's just saying hello. So these attitudes are changing, and people are demanding warmer, drier houses. And over time, that will, I'm sure, flow on throughout the entire country. As people renovate their houses, they also, you know, make them more energy efficient and warmer and drier and all that sort of stuff. But one thing that Bank did mention, leaky homes, has actually nothing to do with this. It actually refers to a mistake that the previous national government made in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, somewhere in there, where they decided that the building code would be changed and builders would no longer be required to use treated timber. Now, the timber is treated to resist, well, insects, but the main thing is to resist rot so that it can actually be in water, stand in water for a while without rotting. And they decided that wasn't necessary anymore, which obviously makes it saves builders money. And unfortunately, that was a really colossally bad idea there, for two reasons. First of all, the style that was popular at the time was, and still is to some extent, was sort of a quasi-Tuscan Santa Fe-ish kind of stucco plaster look. And we call that monolithic cladding when it's basically plaster. And it, when it gets cracks, it can get water into it quite easily. And when the timber isn't underneath it isn't treated, it can it's very easy for the timber to become waterlogged and start rotting. And that can cause all sorts of problems in floors and walls and window framing and all kinds of things. And so this is why this became a political issue, because Parliament passed the new building code and the local councils were required to enforce it. Now, local councils have no say in the building code. They have to just enforce the Building Act as Parliament passes it. And that's it. They don't really, there's nothing more they can do. So this has been hemmed and hawed about for years, with the government saying basically it's not their fault that it was bad advice. And local councils saying, well, hey, we're just doing what Parliament told us to do. And the homeowners being stuck with these massive repair bills. Sometimes, you know, maybe half the value of their house spent just fixing all of these problems. Well, the current national government has introduced a scheme which they say is their final offer, basically. And that is that they'll pay a portion of the cost for repairing these houses, but only some of the houses between certain years, not all of them. The local councils have to pay part and the homeowner has to pay the rest. Now, personally, I think this is grossly unfair because local councils had nothing to do with this. They were just ensuring that they were conducting the inspections to make sure that they complied with the Building Act. But that's their whole role in this. Central government was responsible for creating this mess, and they should be responsible for fixing it. I don't see how it could possibly be considered fair to shove the cost of this back onto the long-suffering ratepayers in the towns and cities across New Zealand who had nothing to do with this. It was all done by the central government, and the central government should find a way to fix it without putting the burden back on cash-strapped towns and councils throughout the country. But that's why it's a political issue. Now, New Zealand's not alone in this. This same thing happened in other towns and cities around the world. I think it was Portland, Oregon, or maybe Vancouver, I can't remember, that had a similar situation where houses were allowed to be built with untreated timber, and they also had leaky homes. The untreated timber can work in a place that's warm and dry most of the year, but it doesn't work in a place like Auckland or the bulk of New Zealand that gets a lot of rain for parts of the year, especially in winter. And that is where the problem started, and the fact that these houses were built in a style that had no eaves or overhangs or whatever you want to call it, so the water could hit the walls directly, and it wasn't long before they were able to get into the houses. Now, it wasn't so long ago that no matter where you drove, you would see houses covered in these great big blue tarpaulins as contractors were in there ripping the walls apart so that they could reframe them. And it was a mess. So starting about 2000, I guess, maybe a little bit later, it became quite common whenever anybody bought a house to require, typically people require a builder's inspection to make sure that, you know, there's no defects in the house that have to be repaired, nothing major before they take possession. But they would also order a weather tightness inspection, which is a bit of a misnomer because they're not just looking to make sure that the house is weather tight. They're also looking to see if there's been any weather damage over the years. And they do that by taking moisture tests. And if they find evidence of moisture, then there's another round of tests that's required that's more invasive. And if that finds water, then you're in trouble because that's when you start to have to spend big money to fix the damage. And once this is discovered, it goes into the council records for your local town or city or whatever, and it goes in this thing that's called a land information memorandum, or a LIM. And when you buy a house, that's another thing you do. You get a copy of the LIM for the property so you can see any problems that have been identified, any permits that have been issued, whether the permits were inspected and passed, all those sorts of things. So you know everything about the property that the government knows. You will also find out if there are any illegal structures on the property. And that's actually a bit of a – that's not quite as alarming as that sounds, because an illegal structure would be like another house. Something like a deck doesn't necessarily require a permit. Depends on how high it is and how big it is. A gazebo doesn't, because it's considered a temporary structure. Things like that. A garden shed doesn't require a permit. But anything that's permanent or considered to be permanent does. And that's the sort of thing that you would look for. And they would know that from the aerial photos of properties. They could see that you've got this big garage that's not permitted. And then they'd say, But when we had our house in Pauroa, it was built in 1950, and they added on two bedrooms in the 1970s, I think about 73, and they had textured ceilings put in. And because of the era, we suspected that the ceilings were actually asbestos, and in fact they were. But we took a sample in and had them tested. And once they determined that it is asbestos, that's reported to the local council, and then you must hire a licensed contractor. I think that's a requirement throughout the U.S. as well. And so we hired them. They came in. They removed the asbestos ceilings, scraped it back to the original plaster, and we were done. And then they issue the government comes back to ensure that there's no asbestos in the air. Once they're satisfied, they issue a final certificate saying so, and you give that to your local council, and all of that goes on the LIM, the Land Information Memorandum. But if you don't have that final stuff done, it will still be on the report that asbestos is present. And that will probably kill a sale, to be honest. And it's one of those things where if you have an old house and you don't know what the ceiling is, a lot of people just won't have it inspected because they don't want to know, because then it goes on the LIM and all that sort of thing. But I mean, smart buyers will look at a textured ceiling, they'll think it probably is asbestos, even if not. And they've got to calculate the cost of removing it in their minds when they're deciding to make an offer. But the point of all that LIM stuff is it protects the buyers from buying lemons as much as possible, because they'll know if there's asbestos, they'll know if the house is leaky, they'll know if there's any work that was done that's not permitted or not inspected. all those sorts of things. So they know what they're getting into. And then you add on top of that an inspection from a builder and maybe a weather tightness inspection, and you've got a really good idea of what you're getting yourself into. And so you know if you can afford it or if you even want to put up with any remedial work that you would have to do. And I think it's a very good system. It seems to work really well. You very seldom hear of people who are really shafted in a house deal anymore. Actually, you very seldom heard about them even before all these changes, but I suppose it happened. To sum up then, basically, these changes have all meant that houses are getting warmer and drier, and the whole sale process is becoming more straightforward and easier to follow, I suppose. So, Benk, I hope that answers your question. If not, by all means, ask a follow-up, and I will try to address that. But now I'm going on to the written comments, and these are from Emrin's 244 and Resume. First, I have to say that my site, emrinspodcast.com, is supposed to send me an email to tell me that there is a comment that needs to be moderated. And what that means is that anybody who has not commented before using a particular email address, I have to approve. And then once they're approved, they go into some database or something, and they're okay to go after that. But the first time they comment, I have to approve it. And also, it catches spam as well. And sometimes those show up as comments that need to be moderated, but generally speaking, they go into the queue for spam, and I can get rid of them. But one of those that I missed was actually filed before I recorded, and it was from Calvin. Now, Calvin is from a podcast called Hello Waffles. And that, there's Sunny again. That, of course, was one of the original podcasts that I listened to way back when. At the time I started my podcast, I said that Calvin was like the midwife to my podcast because he urged me to start one. So if you like this podcast, you can thank Calvin, and if you hate it, you can blame him. But Calvin has recently resumed his Hello Waffles podcast, and I never took the link off of my parade of podcasts because I always hoped that he would come back, and he has. So do check him out. He and his partner JR do their podcast from lovely San Francisco. So in that comment that I didn't see until I'd already posted, Calvin said, "Hidey-ho, Arthurino. I enjoyed listening to your last two shows. It's nice to see some things remain in the podosphere, even if many change. Sounds exciting to have a new dog, Sunny, and I did enjoy the imagery of you walking around as the Pied Piper." Me again. That actually continues to happen. They seem to follow me around where I go, and it's not uncommon for me to turn around and see all three of them looking up at me, which is sometimes a little disconcerting because I'm hoping they're not seeing me as a giant ham or something. Anyway, he goes on. "Ree McDonald's, I think you're right. They're just stupid. They outsource the filter, it sounds, and I honestly think parents are more concerned about their children going to gay sites than white power sites. What parent knows whether their child is secretly one of the enemy? The foil garlic bread is disconcerting. You have a grill going. Just brush bread with oil, grill, take a few raw garlic cloves, and rub them on the grilled bread, and possibly top with cheese. So easy! Actually, not sure if you guys get Reggiano down there. Me again. I don't know about the Reggiano. I can't recall seeing it, but then I actually haven't been looking for it either. But some people do actually make their own garlic bread, but this is ubiquitous, and that's why it still kind of astounds me. It has nothing to do with barbecue, but most barbecues I've been to, they've had garlic bread, which just, I don't really understand. I just don't. But I do have to say, it's actually not bad, because they use real garlic and real butter in these products, and it's just that the bread isn't as good as it could be, but it is nice and salty and buttery and garlicky, so, I mean, I suppose that counts for something. And he concludes, "Also, a bit surprised your niece would find Asian food unusual. I thought your close proximity to Southeast Asia would mean you'd be swimming in coconut milk and fish sauce. Anywho, enjoyed." Thank you, Calvin. And it's not so much that she found it unusual as much as she found it challenging, because she's very finicky about what she eats. Our other niece, her favorite thing in the world is sushi. And during their trip with us, she discovered she liked pickled ginger with her sushi, which she hadn't tried before. And she's game for most things. She'll at least try it, usually. Whereas the other one has become very, picky, I suppose, about what she's her favorite thing are chicken nuggets. Doesn't really matter where they're from particularly, but she really loves those. She also likes spring rolls, and she likes some Asian food. She likes our local Chinese restaurant does their version of chicken satay, and she quite likes that, which I don't really understand because I would think that would be not quite what she would like, but it is. And she likes a few other things here and there as well. I think she likes noodles, I'm pretty sure. But none of them particularly care for pizza, which to me is sacrilege. So they all have their own individual tastes. But in recent months, maybe a year or so, the youngest niece, her tastes have kind of become a bit more restricted. And so, you know, it was for her kind of challenging to try this, but we wanted her to. Of course, Nigel and I, frequently have Asian food, actually, on takeaway night with his sister and our niece. We often have Asian food as takeaway as well. We particularly like Thai and also Indian. And Nigel and I often go to a Japanese restaurant for lunch. That's not far from here. But and of course, there are at least two Asian food courts within easy driving distance of the house. And also on that, Hat M said, I don't totally agree with what you're saying, maybe because you have a niece to protect. Internet access for all sites should be allowed anywhere and on all times if made accessible. One, it is a mistake and a persistent error to consider McDonald's as a kid's fast food. Youngsters are a fragment of the consuming age spending in there. They are in a pretty considerable numbers, but it's still the adults who are paying, and not all of them are parents. McDonald's doesn't really care about the children. They care about losing clients. Me again. You're absolutely right, Hadam, and I actually made a similar point on my blog post about that, about how a lot of their customers are perhaps elderly, or they're just single adults who don't have children, or childless adults of one sort or another, or teenagers, or whatever. They're not kids. And I thought it was foolish for McDonald's to focus only on kids or families with kids to the exclusion of all others. He goes on, one has to be really stupid and desperate to be watching porn in a McDonald's fast food restaurant. Such perverts should beware. Me again. Yeah, I agree. I also don't think it's appropriate to be looking at porn in any public place. I really don't want to be confronted with that when I'm out and about. Most people probably wouldn't. Now, I'm certainly not anti-porn, as anyone who knows me knows. I have no problem with the existence of pornography in general. The issue is where and when it's appropriate, and I don't think it's appropriate out in public like that, certainly not in a restaurant where all sorts of different people are there just to have a meal, and they're not expecting to be seeing that sort of thing. he goes on. Three, it is hypocritical to have a non-flesh-showing nudity policy when the television placed in the fast food show commercials, commercial music video clips, where artists are acting in a more obscene way and showing body parts as well. They are not showing cartoons, but adult stuff. Even from the kids' corner, they can notice it. Me again. And that you're absolutely right, and that's a very good point I hadn't thought of, but it's true. Now, I have noticed that during the daytime on a week, if you go into a McDonald's, that they very often are playing like CNN International or something grown up like that, maybe because they're expecting a business person clientele or something. I don't know. On the weekends, however, they often do show music videos, and not all of them are exactly chaste. And they don't censor those because they're just playing a TV channel. So it is a bit inconsistent. And the thing is, too, that they don't people in New Zealand just wouldn't complain about that. It's not like, you know, that grocery store in Arkansas that covered up a magazine because it had two gay men on the cover. That would never happen in New Zealand. And people also wouldn't complain if there was scantily clad people cavorting in a music video in McDonald's either. Well, the next point is actually relevant to what I was going to say next. Four. There's a thin difference between the concept of nudity and of pornography, and people feel it and get conservative and tabooish about it. Kids and youngsters may not understand such concepts, but it doesn't mean that one should act as if they don't exist. There are ways to explain in a sensible way such things if they accidentally see such thing in a McDonald's. Me again. There is absolutely a difference between nudity and pornography, and that, too, was one of the points I was trying to make in my blog post about it in particular. where I feel that they, the McDonald's was meshing together simple nudity or partial nudity is what it really was, and actual pornography. And in a follow-up article, they did say that some of the ads on gaynz.com were, in their words, explicit. Now, I frequently go to gaynz.com, and I've never seen an ad that I would consider explicit. The ads are all small, and some of them are ads for sex on-site venues or something like that. I don't think they've had any ads for porn as such, at least not that I've seen. But you have to get up close to read it in order to understand what the ad is even about. At most, you'll see a male torso, a shirtless man, and that's about it. So I have a tough time with that description of them as being explicit. But the thing is, like I said in that blog post, if ads are the problem, and apparently they were, why not just block the ads? You don't have to block the entire site because of that. And apparently that's what GANZ and McDonald's were going to try to sort out. 5. If such sites or slightly provocative banners are prohibited, then why not such applications or social sites? Those aren't always as innocent as they seem, despite policies. Nudity is accessible everywhere, even on Wikipedia. Making it inaccessible pushes everybody to look further for ways to access it. It won't stop those who have a need for it. Me again. That's absolutely true, and actually, certain Wikipedia entries dealing with body parts were also blocked at McDonald's. I don't know specifically which body parts, but I think I can use my imagination to figure it out. Now, the ones that I've seen dealing with anatomy on Wikipedia have the engravings from Grey's Anatomy, the book, which is in the public domain now. And they're just very technical illustrations. There's nothing titillating at all about those illustrations. Although, as a kid, I might have felt differently, but that's a story in itself. But, even that stuff got blocked by McDonald's. So it wasn't just ads, and it wasn't just from gay sites or what have you. It was also things like Wikipedia sites. I think they may have changed some of that as well, because that just doesn't make any sense at all. 6, as a private company, they should have the right to discriminate in any kind. It may sound unfair, but it is time for such companies to be truly fair and sincere with their customers. They should stop this game of trying to hide their religious, sexual, political views and be transparent about their acts and opinions. Let the consumer boycott them as they want to. Let them show how greedy companies they are. Because by changing policy suddenly, it doesn't mean they truly think what they're doing is wrong. They just play the game so that they don't lose revenue. Me again. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that companies like McDonald's try to be values neutral, which means that they try not to present themselves as being in favor or against any political agenda or religious view or what have you, but they just try to present an atmosphere, in the case of a restaurant, that welcomes their target customers. But the problem with that is that no matter how benign they think they're being, it still has implications, like when they were blocking sites just because, I would guess, because they have the word gay in them. Like Rainbow Youth, for instance, which has nothing pornographic about it whatsoever, but was a resource for GLBT in questioning youth. And I think that that blocking sites like that was reprehensible. And they apparently agreed because it's no longer blocked. 9, it remains the parents' responsibility to control the children. It is about proper education more than proper protection. It's a shame that parents would think to censor body parts when they let their children look at the news and movies where violence is dominant. And thank you for all of that, Hedem. The final comments are from my previous episode, 245, Birthday Boy. And the first comment is from Calvin, who said, "Happy B-Day, Arthur." Thank you very much, Calvin. And the second comment was from Hat M, who said, "There's already a queen having 2 birthday dates a year, so why not?" And what he's referring to, of course, is Elizabeth, the Queen of New Zealand, has 2 birthdays. Her actual birthday, when she was actually born, is April 21st. And her official birthday here in New Zealand is the first Monday in June, which this year is June 6th. But she actually has many birthdays, because countries around the world who have her as the head of state observe her birthday on a day that makes sense for wherever they're at. And so it's in different days in different parts of the world. So technically, she has a lot of birthdays all over the place. not just two, as she does here. But that's it for today. I probably won't be back this week, but hey, you never know. So until I speak with you again, have a good one.
Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Airman's Podcast at airmanspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at airmanspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.